This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Will Congress reform itself? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today's Wall Street Journal editorializes that both Democrat and Republican lobby reforms are hilariously predictable. Others agree. That's partly because the reforms would limit what lobbyists do rather than members of Congress themselves. What about earmarking money on behalf of special interests? Does refusal to deal with campaign finance create a major loophole? On To The Point, we'll look at proposals from both parties. Would they prevent a legislative calamity like the Medicare drug plan? Will it take fear of indictment to clean up Capitol Hill? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the latest on Jill Carroll, the U.S. reporter kidnapped in Baghdad. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To The Point. In the wake of the Jack Abramoff scandal, both parties say they want to change the ways of Capitol Hill. To The Point, critics say the proposed reforms are aimed more at lobbyists than at members of Congress themselves. Will money always play a political role? Will it take fear of indictment to make a real difference? On Reporter's Notebook, kidnappers of U.S. reporter Jill Carroll threatened to kill her tomorrow. We'll hear about efforts to get her released. First, this news update. The Arabic language network Al Jazeera has broadcast what appears to be the voice of Osama bin Laden, saying that new attacks on the U.S. are being planned. The identity of the speaker has not been confirmed, but White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan was asked why bin Laden has not been captured or killed.
Clearly, he is on the run. Clearly, he is under a lot of pressure, just as other al-Qaeda leaders who are on the run are. And that's why we're going to continue pursuing them and continue going after them to bring them to justice. We have made great progress, but this is a war that continues, and this is a war that we will not let up on until we have prevailed.
Scott McClellan at the White House also said the war on terror is much bigger than a single person. Meantime, what about that audio tape? Magnus Ransdorp is director of asymmetric threat studies at the Swedish National Defense College in Stockholm. Magnus Ransdorp, always good to have you with us.
Yeah, pleasure to be with you.
What will it take to verify whether, in fact, that is the voice of Osama bin Laden?
Well, I think that that's going on right now. The CIA will be analyzing speech patterns, phraseology. They will be looking at the different references. I think this tape is a little bit different because there's not a lot of heavy Quranic references to it, and it's directly appealing to the American people. But I think that by now they should know whether it's real or not.
Does the CIA, is it alone in having the resources to be able to make the verification?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that there are other intelligence agencies, particularly larger ones, who have that capability. So I think that they will also be cross-referencing it, and they will be know relatively quickly whether it's real or not.
Based on the content, does it sound like Osama bin Laden to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm on the outside. I'm not close to those spheres, but I think that the themes he's hitting on certainly would seem to suggest that it could be him.
If, in fact, it does turn out to be him, it'll be the first time he's been heard from in more than a year. Also, it's audio tape, apparently of poor quality. What does that say, given the fact that in the past we've seen him on high-quality videotape?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a little bit indicative of what the White House press secretary stated, that he may be a little bit pressured, and that some of these tapes are made under less than perfect conditions while he's hiding out. We should remember that there was a serious strike and the potential loss of a very key member in a Pakistani village just a few days ago. That certainly seems to indicate that the U.S. is having some success, and that this is making it a little bit more difficult for them to perhaps spend time on preparing to attack and more on security.
Again, we're talking with Magnus Ransdorp in Stockholm. Now, among the things on the tape is the offer of a truce, apparently not very specifically, but apparently related to the idea that the U.S. would pull out of Iraq. Is there a pattern here? Has that been offered before and have attacks followed when the conditions set weren't met?
Well, certainly we should remember that right after the Madrid attack in 2004, Bin Laden offered a specific truce to a 3-month truce that no violence would follow, giving European governments time to withdraw from Iraq, those that are participating side by side with the U.S. And of course, you know, we've had London, we've had a number of different efforts to strike at not just the U.K., but also other Spain and France and other European governments. So I think that, you know, he's trying to appeal to try to divide the people against the administration. And I think on this level, he's making a bit of a miscalculation, and maybe that's what he wants. I mean, but I think it's a miscalculation in terms that this will, of course, galvanize support for Bush and that there is unfinished business. In Europe, this type of tape, this type of content of offering a truce may raise a public discourse that maybe we should withdraw, and that may open up for opportunities to strike to facilitate this more quickly.
Is there any way to judge the validity of the statement on the tape that we Al-Qaeda, resources and people in place to make attacks on the United States?
Well, I think that whether that's true or not, I mean, I think it's very difficult to say. I think that there has been an absence, and I think that's due to the fact that U.S. is constricting in the operational space. It's very difficult for them to travel in the same way that they've done before, but we should also be cognizant of the fact that he also says that that these types of operations take a long time to prepare. And I think there's something, you know, true to this, that he may hit when he's ready on his terms and in a very surprising fashion. So we should take that seriously.
The threat remains, and you think we should take it seriously, bottom line.
I think we should take it seriously, and I think, you know, this is indicative of the fact that we should, you know, we should prepare for the unexpected because that's the way he operates. And
Magnus Ransdorp, thanks so much for being with us, research director at the Swedish National Defense College, rather, in Stockholm. In a moment, can Congress reform itself? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, I'm only back with To the Point. Both Republicans and Democrats have proposed what they call reforms of the practices that produced the Jack Abramoff scandal and brought down Majority Leader Tom DeLay. But despite partisan claims, there may be more similarities than differences, and they both contain at least one major loophole. Jeffrey Birnbaum's books include The Money Men, The Real Story of Fundraising's Influence on Political Power in America. He writes the K Street Confidential column for The Washington Post. And Jeffrey, we're always glad to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Is it fair to say that there appear to be more similarities than differences here?
Yes, absolutely. Both the Republicans and the Democrats want more disclosure about what lobbyists do, and they want to ban or severely restrict privately paid travel and gifts, especially meals, to members of Congress. And they want to stretch out the time before members of Congress and staffers can go downtown to K Street, so to speak, and to become lobbyists after they've served in government. And those things are all pretty much the same.
Any major differences?
Well, one important difference that is probably not going to make it to the final package of proposals would be the Democratic plan to add a great deal more disclosure for lobbyists when they lobby the executive branch of government. That is probably not a bad idea, of course, but I don't think that the Republicans are eager to take that on. There are also some Democratic proposals that are there mostly, I think, for rhetorical purposes, such as the termination of the so-called K Street Project, which has been an effort begun 12 years ago when in the election of 94, the Republicans took over the House of Representatives, an effort by Republicans to coerce major trade associations to hire as their top executives or top lobbyists Republicans only, as a way to control the money flow to members of Congress. I don't see how, I mean, that's a lovely way for Democrats to try to keep the K Street Project in the public's eye, with an eye toward upcoming elections. But I don't see how they can actually shut down such a project if it actually exists in any sense, and I'm not sure that it really does.
Republicans, of course, are in the leadership. Democrats would love to have this as an issue in the upcoming elections later this year. But if there aren't all that many differences, they're still talking as if there are. Do we expect, then, any possibility of compromise, or is it likely that if reforms are passed, there'll be a one-party deal with the Republicans mainly doing it?
Well, I think... First, legislation that will call itself lobbying reform will slice through Congress like a warm knife through butter. There will be legislation, and it will primarily be written by the Republicans who control both the House and the Senate. And not many Democrats will have the courage, or whatever you may want to call it, to vote no. In fact, I don't think anybody, any member of Congress, will vote no because of the political imperative that politicians have to win re-election. They think they need to vote for something called lobbying reform in order to keep their jobs. Some of the more rhetorical or stronger efforts in the Democratic plan make their way into the Republican plan? I'm not sure they will, because the Republican plans, at least from the leadership, are pretty strong as it is. There are some examples of things that are in one Republican plan and not the other that there might be fights over, that, such as drastically expanding disclosure to include grassroots or indirect sorts of lobbying that John McCain in the Senate wants, but the House is not so eager to do. Cracking down in a big way on corporate jet travel by lawmakers. Once again, McCain in the Senate would force lawmakers to pay the full cost of that travel, charter rates, in other words. The same proposal is not in the House version, as another example, and that will be a very big fight, because that's a very easy way for members to get around and mostly go to fundraisers, which is what they want the most. So this could be somewhat watered down, but I'm not sure that that many lawmakers will vote against it, whatever it is, in the end.
All right. On the question of fundraisers, though, that leads us to what you've pointed out as a major loophole in both the Republican and Democratic proposals, which is that they don't address the issue of campaign finance. How is it that campaign finance rules might actually nullify these apparent bans on travel and gift?
Well, this loophole, I think, explains that this is mostly a political effort and not really an effort to change the way Washington works in a fundamental way. The most severe sounding parts of all of these proposals from both parties is a ban on privately paid travel and gifts and or meals from outsiders, wouldn't be the effect of any of the proposals. They would not be banned, because campaign fundraisers, through campaign fundraisers, lobbyists and anybody else from the outside are more than able, and will continue to be more than able, to pay for both travel and meals for members of Congress, because none of the plans affect campaign finance laws. They affect only the laws that deal with gifts, the rules, actually, that deal with gifts from outsiders to members of Congress. There are three kinds of rules or regulations that affect the interaction between lawmakers and lobbyists. One is the gift rules, which would be affected. That's where these bans would come from. Another is the amount of disclosure, the disclosure laws that lobbyists are, the amount of reporting of what they do that they have to make to the public. And the third are campaign finance laws that deal with fundraising for elections. That third area is not being touched, at least so far.
So that means, as I understand it, that if you want to hold a fundraiser in a ski resort during the winter, or in other exotic place at another time of year, you can do that, and they can accept it, including travel to and from, because it's a fundraiser rather than falling under that other rule.
That's right. Another way to say it is that according to in these proposals, a member of Congress cannot go out to dinner or accept travel if they're simply going on a fact-finding mission. But if they're going, if they go to dinner or travel somewhere and also accept a check from the person who's paying for that travel, then it's perfectly okay.
As long as the travel, the check goes into the campaign fund.
That's correct. Not personally, but to a re-election fund. That's right.
Jeffrey Birnbaum, again, writes the K Street Confidential column for the Washington Post. Not much confidential anymore about what's going on K Street. Tom Fitton is president of Judicial Watch. That's a conservative watchdog group that has been aggressively critical of both parties in Congress and in the executive branch. Tom Fitton, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me on again.
Does this loophole, as Jeffrey Birnbaum just suggested, nullify in important ways the alleged reforms?
Well, it is a big loophole, and you perform a public service by pointing it out. And, you know, the question to me isn't so much the reforms and the obvious avenues for bribery and extortion, because that's what we're really talking about here. You know, these gifts, whether they come through nonprofit foundations or these travels and these trips abroad, or through their campaigns, can be perfectly legitimate if there's disclosure and if there's a commitment on the part of the lobbyists and the certainly the congressman or the senator not to talk about policy or tie policy considerations to these contributions. And it seems to me the best reform would be to do what the Justice Department is seemingly intent on doing, which is prosecuting congressmen and their aides and lobbyists involved in bribery scams. Many rules were already in place that, if were followed to the letter and spirit, would have prohibited this type of activity. But because there was no enforcement of not only the core issues, but even the side issues such as meal bans and such, the congressmen thought they could do anything and get away with it. In many ways, they had been right. The Clinton administration began selling public office and invent the practice, but really it metastasized in that administration in terms of modern history. And the Republicans saw him get away with it and decided to incorporate some of his the Clintonite fundraising practices into the way they ran Congress. And, several years later, now we're seeing the fruits of it. And now that the Justice Department is investigating and prosecuting this bribery aggressively, I think that's going to be the best reform in the end.
Let me ask you quickly about something you just said, that it would be perfectly legitimate as long as there's disclosure for congresspeople to accept largesse from lobbyists, as long as they didn't tie it to legislation. Does anybody really believe that it's not tied to legislation?
Well, there are times when the lobbyists are just going to want to place insurance bets down on a particular congressman and hope they'll be paid attention to when it comes time for specific votes and such.
And that's okay?
I'm not naive as to the fact is that lobbyists and associations and citizens ought to have a right to talk to their government and petition their government. And the question is, can you give money to politicians and politicians who share your values in a way that doesn't call into question, that doesn't make you crooked? And I think there are ways of doing that. And congressmen can raise gobs of money quite legally and appropriately, but they don't have to tie specific earmarks, for instance, in the case of Duke Cunningham, who admitted to bribery, or specific policy considerations to discussions. And you know, whatever happened to the rubber chicken circuit where the politicians showed up, made their speeches, and left. And, you know, the lobbyists wanted to be there to show their support. But there's a way of doing it that may not survive public scrutiny, and people are going to be skeptical of it. But there has to be protection of people's First Amendment ability to petition their government.
Tom Fitton, again, president of Judicial Watch, saying prosecuting when it appears that crimes have been committed is the way to deal with these issues. David Sirota is co-chair of the Progressive Legislative Action Network. He formerly was a staff member for Democrats in Washington. He's also author of an upcoming book, Hostile Takeover, which analyzes how corporate interests have influenced America's political system. David Sirota, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Anthony.
What do you say to what we just heard, that in fact it's the law enforcement that's going to clean up the place and that there's nothing you can do about the money, I think is implicit in what Tom Fitton said, particularly when the U.S. Supreme Court has said that freedom of speech includes freedom to give money?
Well, I think we have to look no further than Arizona or Connecticut or a number of state and local municipalities that have passed public financing systems of elections to know that that's just not true. And look, money is always going to get into the process somehow, whether through independent expenditures, 527s, and all the other kind of stuff. The question is whether you can set up a system that downplays the connection between money and politics, that in other words, not only just downplays it, but creates a system whereby the only avenue to political success isn't through raising huge amounts of corporate-connected cash. And I think that, you know, public financing of elections, a voluntary system of public financing of elections, has been successfully implemented in a very, very conservative state in Arizona. It's worked very well. And what's really a commentary on the sad state of our political system is the fact that neither party has talked about public financing of elections in the wake of what is essentially a scandal that surrounds using money to buy votes.
I want to get back to that issue. Before I do, we're going to lose Jeffrey Birnbaum from the Washington Post, and I want to ask him to clarify a term that came up a moment ago, and that is earmarking. Jeffrey, this is another thing that, as I understand it, is not provided for, or not mentioned in either of the reform proposals. What is earmarking? What does it have to do with the Abramoff scandal and the Duke Cunningham scandal? He's the California congressman who has resigned from office, admitting he took bribes.
Well, I think several of the plans do deal, at least rhetorically, with earmarking. So, you know, it's not clear how they deal with earmarking. But
okay.
What are earmarks? Earmarks first have nothing to do with ears. They are narrowly focused appropriations given to individual members of Congress, often at the behest of lawmakers. Of lobbyists. Twelve years ago, there were just a few thousand of these as part of much larger appropriations bills that fund all of government. And now, most recent number last year, there were 15,000 of them. And this has created an entire industry of for lobbyists seeking these multi-million dollar projects for highways or for educational institutions.
Okay, and the bridge to Newhare in Alaska is the most often cited as an earmark, and they are inserted into bills in private, often without any public scrutiny at all, and even after the bills have been passed by the committees. Is that right?
That's correct. They're often just stuck in, okay. And no one knows how they got there.
All right, Jeffrey Birnbaum, we're out of time for this half of our program. We need to go to a break. I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, with the Washington Post. We'll come back. We'll take up again this issue of public financing and other issues as well. On Reporter's Notebook, the latest on Jill Carroll, the U.S. reporter kidnapped in Baghdad. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about proposed lobbying reforms by both parties in Congress. In a moment, I want to talk about the Medicare drug plan as possibly one that is an example of what has gone wrong and ask if the proposed reforms might have prevented what seems to be taking place in that area. First, though, I want to give Tom Fitton of Judicial Watch an opportunity to comment on what David Sirota said, that you said earlier, Tom Fitton, that congresspeople, even though it might not to sound good to the public, ought to be able to accept what you referred to as gobs of money legally without being criticized or without violating the law. David Sirota said, no, the way to deal with this and downplay the role of money is to have public financing, voluntary system like they have in Arizona. We don't have time to go into it in detail, but what do you say to that?
I don't agree with it. I don't think the problem is big money in politics. I think it's big government. And as long as our government spends over $2 trillion a year, money will flow to it like towards a black hole. And the proposal of public financing would substitute the special interest group of government and those that benefit from government with the special interest group of citizens and those who are on the wrong end of government too oftentimes. And I just don't think it's a good idea, and I think incumbent politicians would like nothing more than a reliable, never-ending spigot of money out of the public treasury to fund their campaigns. And it would, to me, be an incumbent protection racket second to none that is already too powerful here in Washington, D.C.
Tom Fenton of Judicial Watch, David Sirota with the Progressive Legislative Action Network. What about that? The problem is big government, not big money, according to Tom Fenton.
Well, I think that's just a classic sort of right-wing rhetoric that doesn't really match up with reality. I think that, you know, right now we have an incumbent protection system. It's called our system of legalized bribery, where 99% of incumbents win and 99% of incumbents outspend their opponents by levels of 8 to 9 to 10 to 1. A public financing system would ensure that there would be more competitive elections. The idea that it would be a wasteful government spending and a huge amount of government resources, right now we spend tens of millions, hundreds of millions, probably billions of dollars promoting democracy abroad. We spend nothing promoting democracy here at home. So I think that's just really a red herring. The fact is, we need a radical change in our system. Our system is dominated by big money. Big money buys elections. That's the problem. The American public knows it. And the American public wants a system that's not the case. Public financing is a system that has shown to have worked. It works in localities. It works in states. And the only reason that both parties are not supporting it is because they are comfortable with the current system whereby big money buys elections for incumbents.
All right. Once again, this is not a program about public financing. We will definitely come back to it on future programs, however, and hope both of you will join us. We'll argue it out in greater detail at that point. In the meantime, let's talk about the Medicare drug plan, touted, of course, by President Bush as a major achievement. But all over the country, senior citizens are grappling now with massive confusion. In Southern California, for example, 48 different plans are available, with premiums ranging from $5 to $66, all of them sponsored by private companies administering a government program to make a profit. Public Citizen is a public advocacy group founded by Ralph Nader. It reports this: 952 lobbyists spent $141 million to get what they wanted in that bill from the Congress. Taylor Lincoln is research director of Public Citizen's Congress Watch. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Elaborate a bit more, if you will, on what was going on in the years before the Medicare drug plan was finally passed.
What you really saw in about the 3 years leading up to the passage of the Medicare prescription drug bill was a forceful, multifaceted, unbridled effort by the pharmaceutical industry essentially to capture the government in a plethora of ways. It involved its massive lobbying campaign, as you mentioned, between the pharmaceutical industry and the HMO industry. They deployed almost 1,000 lobbyists, but it also involved the pharmaceutical industry's usual approach of making large campaign contributions to politicians and to soft money accounts. It also involved a massive grassroots spending effort, and it involved the pharmaceutical industry's practice of shuttling public officials through the revolving door, whether from being a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry to going to work in highly placed positions in the government, or in hiring people in highly placed positions in the government or in Congress to become lobbyists for the industry, or perhaps more subtly holding out the possibility of hiring these public officials, such as members of Congress, after they get what they want, which is another thing that is always out there as a possibility in this town. And I think what that ensured was that the pharmaceutical industry knew by November of 2003, when this bill was up for its highly contentious debate, that they had an awful lot of politicians in their corner that they weren't going to lose. And they had certain things that they desperately wanted to achieve. They wanted to ban reimportation of drugs from Canada and ensure that that would not be legalized. And they also wanted to ensure that the government would not use its buying power to drive down the price of drugs in a massive Medicare entitlement program. To many of us, that might sound like the most democratic of principles, or the most capitalistic of principles, the most market-based for the government to use its negotiating power, but they were able to succeed in getting that categorized as anti-American and were able to get that exemption put into the bill.
What about the confusion that is occurring now, and which has led many states to say they're going to have to take over the program? It's going to cost them a lot of money to do that. Not certain as yet they'll even be reimbursed by the federal government. And what about the confusion, the complexity? 48 programs available in just one area of the country. Is that the result of lobbying too?
Well, I think that anything that you could say is a result of lobbying, or it might be the result of a number of factors coming into play. Some of it is a ideological view on the part of the administration and some Republicans to move Medicare from being less of a government program into being more of a private program. And I think that where this confusion is coming from is that rather than disperse the drugs in a Medicare-administered government program, they introduced this extra layer of the HMOs, of the pharmacy benefit managers, who then came out and are now offering scores of plans throughout the country. And I think it is that proliferation of plans that is making things confusing for seniors. If there was one plan or three plans that were clearly articulated, I think they'd have a lot better shot to understand it more easily.
Okay. Again, Taylor Lincoln is Research Director of Congress Watch for Public Citizen. Let me go back to our other guests and talk about what's been proposed in the way of reform and whether it might have had an impact, had it been an effect, on what we have just heard. I'll go first to you, Tom Fitton of Judicial Watch, especially on this question of the prohibition against using market power with the millions of recipients in Medicare to drive down the price of drugs. One would think that your conservative organization would have objected to that. Would that be taken care of under the reforms that have been proposed?
Well, we didn't have a particular view on the specifics of the policy, but from a conservative perspective, there was suspicion that the government would not make the best choices in its buying decisions and that the private sector was best able, working with consumers, to decide which drugs should be most widely available to the public, and that prices could best be controlled through the market mechanisms of the private sector than the government sector. But I think this whole issue, this program, which, and your other guests can correct me if I'm wrong, is now approaching nearly $600 billion in projected costs, is a prime example of my concern about big government and big corruption. Obviously, there was a lot of money to be had, won and lost, in this proposal, and it's not surprising that there were some backhanded and nefarious deals made. Indeed, I've worked with many groups on the left on this ethics coalition, a congressional ethics coalition, including a Public Citizen. The report on Tom DeLay over this Medicare vote, where a member of Congress was allegedly extorted and attempted to be bribed in order to get his vote, Duke Cunningham, who was later admitted to bribery, had his wallet out on the House floor, and he was banging his wallet against his hand with respect to this congressman's son's campaign, saying, "No money for your son unless you vote this way," and this was tolerated by the House leadership, and lo and behold, we get this massive government program. You know, big government, big socialism, the worst of all worlds, and now we're finding out that maybe the people were getting some benefits they shouldn't have gotten after the result.
Assuming for the purposes of argument only that it's a good idea for the government to see that poor people do get drugs and that the government ought to be involved in doing that, would the kinds of reforms being proposed now by either Republicans or Democrats have effectively eliminated any of the abuses we just heard about?
Well, I mean, there's an argument here over policy. Do you have the private? Do you have the government provide this program through private sector representatives, or do you have the government run the whole thing? And you're still not going to get around that argument in the end. There's a philosophical difference on how government ought to operate and how our medical system ought to operate, free of government interference or as least government interference as possible. So even assuming you're in arguendo that the government should be behind this type of program, you're still going to get conservatives, even in the worst of that world, to want to try to get the private sector involved.
Okay.
And there's going to be a lot of interest in getting and the private sector is going to have an interest in getting a piece of that money that the government's going to be spending on this new program.
Tom Fitton of Judicial Watch. back to David Sirota with the Progressive Legislative Action Network. What do you say? Would the I presume you agree there were abuses here, and I suspect you also believe it's a good idea for the government to be involved in this. Do you think that the proposals made now for reform by either Democrats or Republicans would have led to a better Medicare drug program than we've got?
Absolutely not. Basically, the pharmaceutical industry has spent tens of millions of dollars on campaigns, on manipulating campaigns, on television advertising campaigns against people who do not support its interests. I've been a part of campaigns where we've been targeted by the drug industry. Out here in Montana in 2000, the drug industry did everything it could through tens of millions of dollars into trying to defeat candidates who basically were for reimportation of prescription drugs. And so the answer is no, because none of the reforms being proposed deal with the real intersection of money and politics. Basically, again, I sound like a broken record, but until you fundamentally address the fact that politicians are forced to exist and survive based on how much big money they can raise, you will never actually stop any of these abuses.
You say that there was targeting of candidates in Montana by the drug industry on this issue of reimportation of drugs. Don't they have a right to do that?
No. Right now, federal law, the drug industry has made sure that federal law legally prohibits citizens from purchasing medicines from abroad. No.
I mean, don't the drug companies have the right under the First Amendment to target anybody they want for any reason they want?
Well, that's right. Except the problem is you don't have a system by which candidates can fight back. You don't have a system where candidates have the resources to level the playing field. So essentially, the drug industry can come into a state where media is relatively cheap, spend millions of dollars, flood the airwaves, and the candidate who they are targeting, obviously because they're forced to raise money from big money interests, can't really raise as much resources to fight back against big money interests. So in other words, you have a system where politicians have every incentive not to stand up to big money interests because the way that they get elected is weighted towards rewarding big money interests.
Okay, Tom Fitton, back to you with Judicial Watch. Is the system as it's described by David Sirota, and if so, is that a good thing?
Well, you know, David's partially correct. The system is weighted towards incumbents. There is effectively public financing of campaigns in the sense that incumbents use public resources to finance their own campaigns through these Medicare-type programs or earmarks or other government spending programs to buy more votes. And one of the reasons they are often unchallenged is because of the government regulations put in place by incumbents that prevent opponents from raising significant amounts of money to challenge them. So it's very difficult to mount a challenge against an incumbent under our current finance system because you can't raise enough money. The limits are too stringent. And as a result, incumbents really get mostly a free ride in their reelection campaigns. I mean, David knows the stats. Incumbents who are seriously challenged by an opponent in any congressional election cycle, you can count that number on your hand.
Well, a lot of that has to do with reapportionment too, does it not?
It does in part have to do with reapportionment, but certainly a lot more folks would have primary challenges if the financing was more amenable to it.
Let me go back to Taylor Lincoln of Congress Watch, the Division of Public Citizen, Ralph Nader organization funded in 1971. You're an advocacy group. Neither of our other guests obviously thinks that the current reforms being proposed would have produced a better Medicare drug plan, however they come down philosophically. Are there reforms that might do that?
Yeah, and I come down much closer to David's point of view than Tom's, but there is a reform that everybody in town knows about right now, and both parties are afraid to talk about, that would be less far-reaching than instituting publicly financed elections, which would be a radical change to our system. It can be done, and neither party wants to do it, and that is to ban lobbyist contributions to candidates and to ban lobbyists from coordinating contributions, bundling money for candidates, and serving as campaign treasurers and treasurers of PAC, which is really the service that lobbyists perform. It's not so much the money they give out of their own checkbooks, though that's substantial, but the real service that they perform is they act as these politicians' fundraisers. And that is a ban that could be proposed that I think the majority of Americans would support. And I think that that is much more than the proposals that are being bandied around right now, the sort of reform that could result in a profound change in how Washington does business.
And you use the term bundling. What exactly does bundling mean, and how does that relate to the limits on campaign contributions?
Bundling is the practice of me as a fundraiser for you going to 20 or 50 of my friends and getting them to write checks to you or to the politician. For instance, George Bush in 2000 and 2004 employed a platoon of bundlers whom he dubbed his Rangers and his Pioneers. The Rangers were people who raised $200,000 for him. The Pioneers were people who raised $100,000 for him. And notably, there were more than 20 pharmaceutical industry executives or pharmaceutical industry lobbyists among President Bush's cast of Rangers and Pioneers. And had Kerry won, there were a few pharmaceutical industry lobbyists that were bundlers for him as well. So that is a practice through which lobbyists really serve politicians and have something to come ask for in return, you know, when they succeed in getting these politicians elected.
Do they have to talk about it? Tom Fenton said a moment ago that if they accept gobs of money, that's okay, as long as they don't discuss legislation specifically. When a lobbyist is the fundraiser and on the staff of a congressman going out and bundling contributions, do they refrain from discussing what the lobbyist really wants?
Well, I don't know if they refrain from discussing what they really want, but certainly the politicians are well acquainted with who their fundraisers were. And Bush, you know, his Ranger and Pioneer program really was a way to set up a competition to get these people competing against one another. And I think that if you were to have a lobbyist on your show, there's certainly many of them that discuss being badgered for campaign contributions and essentially threatened, whether explicitly or implicitly, that if they don't raise money for the politicians, they're not going to get what they really want, which is access. They need to get their phone calls returned. They need to be able to get in to get a meeting to make a presentation. And Tom DeLay is notorious for a pay-to-play ethic or a transactional politics ethic, which is you pay to get in, and if you don't pay, you don't get in.
All right, running short of time, and Tom Fenton of Judicial Watch, quickly, what about banning these practices of bundling and serving as the fundraiser for an elected official?
Well, I think that's an issue that's coming up, and I don't know if I buy into it, given, but I do want to look at it more. But let me disagree with Taylor a little bit. I think we're a lot closer to doing that, and it would not surprise me if both parties signed on to that relatively quickly.
Okay.
The lobbying forms that are being presented now would have been unfathomable just a year ago.
Okay, David Sirota, very quickly, do you think that that particular practice, those practices, the bundling, the fundraiser relationship, might in fact be part of ultimate reforms?
I think it might be, and I think I recently saw a story in one of the papers that said at least some of the lobbyists would feel relieved that they wouldn't always be targets of shakedown operations.
Okay. And I must say, we have had lobbyists on our program, and they have said that they were treated in that way. Thanks to all of you. We'll come back, talk about this again. David Sirota with the Progressive Legislative Action Network, Tom Fenton, Judicial Watch, Taylor Lincoln with Public Citizen, and our earlier guest, Jeffrey Birnbaum of The Washington Post. In Iraq, 6 of 8 women prisoners may be released on Sunday by a commission including Iraqis and U.S. military officials. Not clear, though, if that possible action is related to the demands of kidnappers holding Jill Carroll, the freelance journalist for the Christian Science Monitor. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Foreman Only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The mother of reporter Jill Carroll has made a televised plea for her daughter's release, saying the kidnappers picked the wrong person because Jill's worked so hard to show the sufferings of Iraqis to the world. Mary Beth Carroll's anguished appeal 12 days after the kidnapping and a day before the deadline set by the captors who are threatening to kill Jill, the reporter. Bobby Ghosh is a senior correspondent for Time magazine. He's recently returned from Baghdad, and he is acquainted with Jill Carroll. Bobby Ghosh, thanks a lot for joining us.
Anytime.
Before we get to Jill herself, the Muslim Brotherhood in Cairo has asked for mercy in this case. The Council on American-Islamic Relations, CARE, has sent a delegation to Iraq. Is there any reason at this point to think that those pleas might be heard?
I think they're certainly being heard, and I suspect that the reaction was the demand we heard yesterday for the release of the women prisoners. Let me explain. Kidnapping a woman is a very unpopular thing in Iraq. Very few women have been kidnapped, and when it's happened, the kidnappers have got no public sympathy for it at all. And I suspect that their demand for the release of the women is their way of saying, okay, we've kidnapped a woman, but they're trying to justify it by saying we did it for secure the release of other women, and therefore somehow this is justified. So that would suggest to me that the criticism that has been directed at them is working to some extent.
It appears, as I understand it, that there are only 8 women who are in fact being imprisoned by the Iraqi and American authorities out of how many total prisoners in that country?
Several thousands. I don't have the number at the top of my mind, but that also tells you something. There are very, very few women prisoners in Iraq, whether they're being held by the Americans or even by the Iraqi government.
So does it appear then that this offer to release 6 of the 8 women hasn't been confirmed by anybody, but does it appear that there might be some sort of compromised reach here?
The Iraqis are saying that this is not a response to the demand and that these women were going to be released anyway. It's not uncommon for the Iraqi government to release women prisoners after holding them for a very short time. But what it certainly does, whether or not this was a direct response to the demand, it certainly allows the kidnappers to back off if they are so inclined. It allows them to back off from that deadline and say, okay, we take note that there's been some heed to our demand and some women have been released, and so we're now prepared to have a further conversation about Jill. And for me, that's a positive development.
Bobby Ghosh, again, correspondent for Time Magazine, acquainted with Jill. Carol, what about her mother's contention, the way she phrased it, that here was a person who was trying to show the sufferings of Iraqis to the rest of the world?
She was absolutely right. And all of us who've known Jim have been saying this for days now. Of all the journalists out in Baghdad, many of us have the tendency to get lost among the talking heads of the story. We talk to heads of the military, we talk to heads of government, and we try to understand that story from the perspective of grand strategy and big country politics. Jill's journalism, if you read her stories, the thread throughout it is a curiosity and a desire to understand what's going on in Iraq from the point of view of ordinary Iraqis. She's not the sort of journalist who hangs out at press conferences or tries to get interviews with big generals. She wants to know what's happening to ordinary Iraqis. It's not at all what her mother said is not even the slightest bit an exaggeration. It describes Jill perfectly.
And she even dresses, as I understand it, as many Iraqi women now are dressing, many more of them since the invasion. Describe that and what that means for a woman moving about in Baghdad.
Well, almost all women journalists in Baghdad take that precaution. They wear the headdress. It serves two purposes. To some extent, it allows you to pass, if you're lucky enough, unnoticed in a crowd, and if your car is passing through a busy street and you have Islamic headdress on, people, out of respect, will not stare. The other reason, and the reason Jill usually gave for the wearing that sort of dress, it shows respect for the people that you're meeting. She always said that when wearing Iraqi or Arab-style clothing allowed her to penetrate into Iraqi families in a way that she would not have been if she had just been wearing jeans and a T-shirt. She felt that Iraqis responded to her because she showed respect for their culture and their dress.
So in a real sense, then, these kidnappers may well have picked up the wrong person.
Oh, there is absolutely no question. I mean, there is no such thing as the right person to kidnap.
Of course.
There is no doubt that if there is one wrong person to kidnap in that whole country, it's Jill Carroll.
What about the impact of all of this on other reporters in Baghdad? You've been there. I suspect
Yes.
You're probably going back.
Yeah.
What's it done, and how vulnerable does it make people feel?
Well, unfortunately, it takes rude shocks like this to remind us of how dangerous things are. When you're there long enough, you sometimes there's a tendency to forget. There's a tendency to be tempted anyway to cut corners when it comes to personal security. Sometimes you say, "Ah, the hell with this. Let me just go to this neighborhood and meet this guy. What are the chances that I'll be grabbed?" Even when you know that it's a dangerous neighborhood and it's not a good idea to go there. Something like this happens, and it's a terrible reminder for all of us that nobody's safe, there's no such thing as a safe neighborhood, and no risks are worth taking.
And in her case, quite different to be moving about with a headdress and all of that, when many journalists, as I understand it, are involved with two cars, one in which they're riding and then another behind with guards who might or might not be armed.
That is correct. As Time Magazine, we have... We follow that system on the advice of our security advisors.
Okay.
We have a chase car, but freelancers, as Jill is, or people who work for papers with smaller resources, as the Monitor is, don't have that luxury.
All right. We all have high hopes for Jill Carroll. Bobby Ghosh, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Jonah King with Carolyn Radziner and Katie Cooper, Technical Director Mike Newport. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.